Hello and welcome to episode number 47 of Golf Pod Kentucky presented by KT Tape. My name is Ethan Fisher. I'm the host of this podcast. And for new time listeners, welcome. For those of you who have been along since the beginning, welcome back. It's a pleasure to have you all on here, and I'm very excited about this episode. We have on Mallory Blackwelder Trudeau, who has been somebody who I've wanted to have on this podcast since its inception. I'll dive in more into Mallory and her interview in a few minutes, but first, let's go over some things that have been happening within the Kentucky golf world as of late. We're going to start out by going back to April 25th at Oxmoor Country Club when the organization hosted its first ever Hope for Heroes event. This was a four-person scramble that took place at Oxmoor, as I said, and all the funds from this event went to our PGA Hope Kentucky programs. As a reminder, those are Louisville at Quail Chase, Florence at World of Golf, Boots Randolph Golf Course in Cadiz, and PGA Hope Paducah, which is at Country Club of Paducah. But we generated more than $1,500 for each of those programs. This event was a mixed event where you had at least one veteran on each team, plus either another veteran or a PGA professional, an amateur, some combination of it, but it was an exceptionally fun day. We were lucky just to have it, given the fact that the weather forecast looked pretty dire going in, but Mother Nature smiled on us for once, and we were able to get it off without much of a hitch. And as I said, everyone had a great time. It really could not have gone much better. We were just so impressed with how things played out. We want to thank everyone for their time and energy supporting the event and making it a point to give back to our veterans who've obviously done more than we could ever pay for. But a quick shout out to our winning team, which was the group of Eric Jocelyn, Lee Handel, and Michael Hayes. They were the best by two shots, I believe, that day. And honestly, everyone was a winner regardless, though, of what the actual score was. I took pen to paper and wrote some of my thoughts about it, which you can find at kygolf.org, just kind of summarizing the day and its impact. But once again, thank you to everyone who supported the event, and hopefully we will have bigger and better editions of Hope for Heroes going forward now that we've got this first one under our belt. On the junior tour front, we had a big one this past weekend at Kearney Hill Golf Links. This was the Lexington Junior City Championship, and you might remember earlier in the winter we announced that that event was going to be jointly operated by both us and Play Golf Lexington. We had the biggest field in the 20-plus year history of the tournament. It was about 135 players from all divisions who came out to play, and the weather was perfect, the golf course was immaculate, and it really just could not have gone much better. We were super impressed with how everything went. A big shout out to everyone at Play Golf Lex, Curtis, who's kind of the man in charge with the city government there in the golf department, Chris Boysell, the PGA golf professional at Kearney Hill. It was immaculate. We could not have asked for anything better on our front, and it seemed like players, parents, you all were really happy, so thank you for coming out and supporting the event. But we had a couple of very good champions come out of it. The overall boys winner was Sam Guest, who shot 2 under par for the 36-hole tournament. He was the only 18-hole boy who finished under par. It was a little tough out there with the wind being the way it was, especially on Sunday. And then Athena Singh, who has just been a very constant refrain amongst different things so far this year. She won the opening tournament on the Junior Tour calendar, the season kickoff. She was at drive, chip, and putt, and then she just ran away with the overall girls' title this weekend, winning by more than a dozen shots. She was 4 under at one point early in her first round that just kind of set the tone that this was going to be a nice little stroll for her. It just doesn't seem like she's ever under any stress. But as I said, she won the overall girls' title, and what's cool is that both of those players are going to get exemptions into Lexington's men's and women's city championships, which are held in July. So a nice little sprinkle on top of the things that the winners get. And then I do want to shout out everyone else who got a win in the younger divisions, those being Weston Miller, Mackenzie Fetterspiel, Rowdy Harris, Carolyn Mendenhall, Matthew White, Charlie Hicks, and Reddick Johnson. Congrats to all of you, and once more, thank you to everyone involved with the event for making it such a success. We had our first Pro-Am of 2022 at Big Spring Country Club's Harmony Landing course on Monday, May 2nd. Nick Johnston, who is a guest of this podcast from earlier in the year, he won both the low professional portion of the event and the namesake pro senior, leading his team to victory. That team also included Brad Thomas, Jeff Kelso, and Dan DeMuth. They won by a couple of shots, where the format was you take one gross score from your team on each hole and then one net score. 80% of amateurs' handicap indexes were used, but Nick Johnston shooting 4-under by himself certainly helped. His teammates were all very helpful as well, and as a result, they get the dub at Harmony Landing. And then also, since the time we had our last podcast, we've had two AM Series events take place to get the KGA calendar rolling along. The first one was held at Neville Mead Golf Club on April 26th, and the best score we had that day was from Jim Murphy of the Masters Division, who shot even par, and that was with a lost ball, he played from the wrong tee on one hole and still shot 72. That's not too shabby. So congrats to him on being the leader that day. And then just a few days later, Shawnee Golf Course was host of the second AM Series event of the year. Camden Robertson, who is new to Kentucky after being from Texas originally, he shot 3-under par around Shawnee to have the low score there. So thanks to everyone who's played in each of those AM Series events. The AM Series will resume at the club we were just talking about, Harmony Landing, in mid-June. And then this is a big month for KGA competition as a whole. We've got our U.S. Open qualifier at Kearney Hill coming up. We've got the Kentucky Team Championship at Frankfort Country Club, Senior Team Championship at Danville Country Club, and I might be forgetting one as well. So it's a very busy time of the calendar for KGA events. If you're not already participating, then you should get involved. All of it leading up to the Clark's Pump and Shop Kentucky Amateur and Women's Kentucky Amateur, which will be held in mid-June at Indian Hills and Cherry Blossom, respectively. So let's steer in now to our conversation with Mallory. As I said at the top, this was an interview I've really been wanting to get. And the first time I'd ever heard Mallory's name was at Big Break Ireland, which it's hard to believe came out a little over 10 years ago. But for those of you who've listened before, you've heard me reference before that I grew up in Colorado, so I've had no context as to what Mallory had done locally or what the Blackwelder family really meant to Kentucky golf. But she was one of the most popular personalities, I think, in Big Break history. That's not me being biased. I think if you look up just what people thought about her, her personality, her golf game, I don't think that's much of a stretch. She was a very captivating person to watch on the show. And then, as fate would have it, obviously I'm in Kentucky now, so it was very cool for me to get to do this interview with her. She's very forthcoming, open about a lot of different stuff. I'm excited for y'all to hear about it. So let's go ahead and get into it with Mallory Blackwelder Trudeau. All right, I'm now excited to welcome aboard a two-time winner of the Kentucky Women's Open, a two-time participant of the U.S. Women's Open, and if my information is correct, she and her mom, Myra, were the first ever mom and daughter to hold LPGA Tour membership at the same time. So Mallory Blackwelder Trudeau, welcome on. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me. I'm doing well.
Good. So there are a lot of things I want to talk about. You have a very strong argument, in my opinion, of being the most interesting woman in Kentucky golf. And given your family's history with the sport, there's a lot to start with. So let's go ahead and begin there. If you want to kind of talk about all the different ways that your parents and anyone who maybe we're not as familiar with has been involved with the sport and how that kind of got you hooked into the sport.
Yeah. So I guess taking it way back, my mom grew up here in Kentucky and started playing golf, you know, as a kid with, you know, at that time it was basically her and all the guys. And, you know, from the stories that I hear, she got pretty good pretty fast and started beating up on all the guys at the golf course. So she was actually part of, if I'm not mistaken, the first women's golf team at UK. So she was a freshman the first year of that, I believe. And she was actually, I also believe, the first Title IX women's athlete scholarship at UK. So that's pretty cool. So she, she played for UK and then she went on to play on the LPGA tour. She and my dad met at the Q school. He was there caddying for somebody else. He had grown up in North Carolina and was in the golf business at that time. And so they met at Q school and got together and she played on the tour and he caddied and then they got married and had my brother and I. And so we basically grew up on the tour for like the first, well, basically until my brother had to start school. So he's a couple years older than me. And so when he had to go to kindergarten, that's kind of when he and I came home with my dad, actually. And so my dad got, a quote unquote regular job. And my mom kept playing on the tour for a couple years. So yeah, the beginning of my life was basically spent traveling on the LPGA tour in a motorhome with my family. So I kind of got started in golf, pretty early. Basically had a club in my hand since I could walk. And yeah, basically my family's not really ever known anything but golf life.
Yeah. Was there anything specific with golf that really hooked you on? Like, obviously, there's a lot of different things that get people interested, but what was the one big thing that really captivated your interest with it?
You know, it's actually funny because I, as a young kid, like, toddler and elementary school, I really actually wasn't that interested in it. I mean, we would go out and play as a family and we'd go to the golf course and go to the range. And when my mom stopped playing, I guess her last, I think, full season was like in 1990. So I was three. And then she came home and started teaching golf. So we would go out to the range with her while she was, given lessons and just kind of mess around. And I really wasn't that interested in it. And until a little bit later, she signed me up for, at that time, it was the Pepsi Tour. And I think there were like six tournaments that you could play in. And so she said, okay, I'm going to sign you up for six tournaments. We're going to get you started. But if you don't like it, let's go play one tournament. And if you don't like it, you never have to do it again. Like, we're not going to force you. Let's just try it. And at that time, before the tournaments, I had, at that time, my dad was the head pro at what used to be called the Campbell House, which is now Picadome. And so, I was doing their junior golf programs. And, basically, it was just me with a bunch of boys. And I just really wasn't that into it. And so once I got on the Pepsi tour and played in my first tournament and realized, oh, there's other girls that do this too. This is more fun. So it was like I met a couple of friends, one specifically who was from the Ashland area. And I met her and she invited me up to her house for a week and, played a bunch of golf with her while we were up there. And we'd go play golf and go to the pool. And it was like once I realized that was when I was about 11. So once I realized that there were other girls playing too, and that if I played in these tournaments, I would get to see my friends, that's honestly how I got into it. Because up until that point, I really wasn't that into it.
Were there any other sports that you tried growing up?
Not at that time when I was I played basketball for a little while, and then I played 1 year of volleyball in middle school, but I'm only 5'5", and it was pretty clear that I was not going to be very tall, so neither one of those sports would have been a very good choice.
Yeah, I hear you there. But with golf, it obviously worked very well. Helps when you've got the bloodline that you do, and you were pretty highly recruited during high school. You ended up choosing the University of Florida to start out with at first. What was it about Gainesville that appealed to you and ultimately made that your original choice for college?
Well, that's another funny story because I actually verbally committed without ever even visiting campus or going to Gainesville. So the way that kind of happened was, I don't exactly know how the rules are now, but basically July 1st after my junior year of high school was when coaches were allowed to start, actually contacting players. And so the AJGA actually hosted a tournament at Andover, and it was that week. And so, a couple different coaches were coming to watch me play. So Jill Briles Hinton, the coach at Florida at that time, came to Lexington to watch the AJGA tournament. And I can't remember exactly what day it was, but whatever day fell on July 1st when she was allowed to talk to me, she came to my parents' house and said, "I have one full scholarship for your graduating class. I'm offering it to you, Paula Creamer, Julieta Granada, who was an LPGA Tour winner, and a girl named Nanette Hill, who also went on to play on the tour. And she said, whoever commits first gets it. So I was like, well, I mean, it's Florida, so you kind of can't go wrong. So, okay, I'll do it. So basically, she said that I thought on it and discussed it with my parents that night, and then I committed the next day.
Well,
So,
that's a good list of company that you had there. Those are some pretty
well,
stout
and I,
names.
yeah, I mean, that was the thing. I kind of knew, like, I knew Paula wasn't going to go to college. That was kind of a given already, even though she hadn't announced that. And then Julieta, I think, ended up turning pro also. She did not go to school. And then Nanette ended up going to Wake Forest. But yeah, I mean, at that time, you know, those were some of the top ranked players in the country. And I just was like, well, I mean, I just felt like I couldn't really go wrong with the decision. So
Yeah.
I just kind of went for it.
So how many years did you end up playing for the Gators?
So I was there for 2 years. So I graduated high school from Woodford County in 2005 and then played for Florida, you know, 05, 06, 06, 07, and then transferred to Kentucky.
So the transfer to UK, I was doing some reading before we hopped on here, and I was reading about your college days for both Florida and Kentucky. And your mom, Myra, she became the women's golf coach at Kentucky. Was that the lone impetus thing that led to you transferring? Obviously, you were coming back home, but what was the whole transfer period like, and what other factors led to you making that decision?
Yeah, so I absolutely loved Gainesville. I loved Florida, loved my team, just had an amazing experience there. And my freshman year, I played really well. I won a tournament and I actually won UK's tournament, which was kind of cool. But then I kind of went through a sophomore slump. And so at the end of my sophomore year, I think by that point, I already knew that my mom had signed on to take the job the next year at UK. But we talked about it as a family a lot. And because I loved Florida so much, at first I said, you know what, I'm not going to come home and play at UK. I'm just going to stay at Florida. You know, I really loved it. I was having a great time. And then I came home for the summer. And like I said, I had not been playing as well my sophomore year. So I came home for the summer, and of course, my mom was my swing coach. And just being home and working with her again, I started playing a lot better. And that summer, I won the Women's Western Amateur, and I finished second or runner up in the Trans Women's Amateur, and got my highest ranking in the amateur golf rankings. I got all the way up to rank number 3 in the country. And I was a Curtis Cup alternate. And it was like that summer, just being home and working with her again, I realized, you know, how much better I was playing. And so then I kind of rethought the whole thing and said, you know, another factor was that if she was coaching at UK and I'm playing at Florida, you know, it would have been a little bit weird as far as her still being my swing coach, you know, coaching a player that's on a competing team within the SEC. And, you know, just the more we thought about it, the more it was kind of like, well, maybe it does make sense for me just to come home. So, talked to my coaches at Florida, kind of told them that that was my intention. And so they released me because obviously they understood. But at that time, the rule was that I was going to have to redshirt because I was transferring within conference. So I applied for a waiver to that rule just because of the circumstance that, you know, I was coming home to play for my mom. I wasn't leaving for any other reason. And they denied that waiver. So then I was playing in the US Amateur at Crooked Stick in Indianapolis, you know, and it's televised. And so in one of my match play matches, Dottie Pepper was doing the commentating. And so my dad had caddied for Dottie several years in the past, so she knew us very well. And she basically, during the telecast, so after they denied my waiver, I had applied for an appeal. Anyway, during the telecast, she was kind of explaining the situation, saying, you know, Mallory's transferring back home to play for her mom, but she's going to have to redshirt. And she basically, on the telecast, said that she thought that was kind of ridiculous that they were going to make me redshirt. And then the next day, the SEC notified us that my appeal went through. So, I mean, I don't know if that was just like complete coincidence. But I woke up the next, I lost my match, drove home, and then the next day my mom, you know, that morning said, "Hey, I've got good news. You don't have to redshirt." So yeah, that was kind of an interesting turn of events.
I'm going to guess, just based on being an avid golf watcher, that probably wasn't a coincidence, because once Dottie starts going and she starts giving her opinion, I wouldn't want to be standing in her way.
Yeah, exactly.
So, starting with your time at UK and then really through that and kind of your first couple years afterwards when you turned pro, what were those several years like? What was the state of your game? What were some of the coolest experiences you had? But also at the same time, what were some of the lows of that time period?
So I mean, when I transferred, you know, I knew it was going to be different. Obviously, you know, coming back to, you know, a little bit different climate, and you know, at that team, sorry, at that time, the you know, the UK women's golf team was not ranked all that high, and you know, Florida, we'd been super competitive, you know, qualified for NCAA regionals and all that kind of stuff, nationals. So, you know, I knew that that was going to be a little bit different, but I was excited to try to kind of, you know, help rebuild, you know, the UK program a little bit. So, you know, it had its unique challenges playing for my mom. I mean, we're super close, and we, you know, have always had an amazing, not only mother-daughter relationship, but kind of player-coach relationship. But it was really, really important for both of us to, you know, make sure that she never, you know, showed any favoritism or, you know, leniency on me. So I, you know, felt like I needed to be on my very best behavior, play, you know, play really well and always earn my spot, which luckily, you know, whatever the, you know, qualifying exemption rules, you know, a couple times we would have qualifying and I would, you know, just qualify. Or if I finished, you know, high enough in a tournament, like I think she had a rule that if you finished like top 20, you didn't have to qualify for the next one or whatever. So that was good that, you know, I never had to be picked to travel or anything like that. I always, you know, qualified on my own merit. And you know, I think overall it was a really great experience playing for her. There was never any conflict. I'm sure my teammates, you know, there was never any issue with them. I'm sure that they, you know, maybe felt like they also had to like, you know, behave around me too, which was probably a little bit different. I'll put it this way. It was definitely a little bit different college experience once I came home versus when I was at Florida.
Sure.
Because I just felt like I needed to, you know, just be on my best behavior, basically. Yeah, and then once I graduated, you know, turned pro, went to all the Q schools. So at that time, you had to go to the separate Symetra Tour Q school, I guess now called the Epson Tour. So that was totally separate from LPGA Q school. I also went to the Ladies European Tour Q school that first year out of school and got status on all three tours, which was great, but also made it a little bit difficult to plan my schedule. So I think I played about, I don't know, 12 events on the European Tour that first year. My rookie year in 2010, played three LPGA events and then a handful of Symetra Tour events. So it was that year was a bit of a whirlwind, and I think that was kind of a rookie mistake. I should have just focused on one tour, you know, looking back. But it was an awesome experience, and you know, I got to travel all over the world, and so that was really cool.
One thing I wanted to bring up regarding the Ladies European Tour, what was it like for you going to all these different countries and doing a lot of worldwide travel? I don't know off the top of my head what their schedule was like a dozen or so years ago when you would have been on it, but like looking through their schedule now, they've got events ranging from Thailand to Belgium, a lot of non-English speaking countries. So what was it like being in these places and playing golf there?
Yeah, I mean it was amazing. So my dad at that time had been caddying for Julie Inkster, and she was, you know, kind of starting to wind down her career a bit. And so once I got my tour card, you know, they kind of came to a mutual decision. Julie just basically said, "Look, Worth, like, you know, your daughter's about to go out on the tour. You just need to caddy for her." So he came out and caddied for me most of the year that year, which was great because, you know, 21-year-old, you know, female traveling the world by herself, that would have been a little bit intimidating. So I was glad to have him with me, not only just as a dad, but my caddy. So our first event was actually in Morocco. And I mean, it was just surreal, you know? I mean, it's like I had been to Mexico on spring break, and I'd been to Canada. That was the extent of my international travel at that time. So got to play in Morocco, Turkey, Germany, Finland. I went to India that year. Like I mean, it was just amazing.
Yeah, and I've asked a couple of other people about similar topics when they've done similar stuff, and I know Steve Flesh, for instance, I think he said that playing in Asia as a young professional was maybe the best thing he ever did, both as a person and as a golfer, when it came to helping him out on and off the course later in life. So I'm sure you could kind of attest to that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it was just really eye-opening. You know, not only just different kinds of golf courses and weather and you know, that type of aspect, but just yeah, seeing different parts of the world and, the amazing places and then, the poverty-stricken areas. That was kind of a wake-up call that obviously and, until you see it, you don't really understand, how people in other parts of the world are living. And so yeah, it was a really amazing experience, and I'm super thankful that I got to do that. My only kind of regret, and as I kind of mentioned earlier, I really wish that I had fully just committed to playing on the European tour that year, as opposed to bouncing back and forth. So I had full European tour status and I had conditional LPGA status. And for example, I played the European tour events in Ireland and Wales. And then the next week, I found out that I was first alternate in the LPGA event in Portland, Oregon. So I flew from Dublin to Portland as first alternate. Thank goodness, once I landed at JFK, I found out I got in the tournament. I didn't make the trip for nothing. But then, I was so exhausted when I got to Portland. I missed the cut, and then I went back and played in Finland the next week. So it was like that was just, I mean, that was just stupid. But at that time, I just felt like I couldn't pass up, an opportunity to play in an LPGA event. And in hindsight, it would have just been better. I had originally planned to just spend my off week hanging out in Ireland and, resting up for the next stretch of tournaments on the LET. And so at the end of that first year, they had a regulation that you had to play a certain amount of events to keep your European tour status. And I had met that criteria, but I was qualified for the year-end kind of like tour championship in Dubai. But that happened to fall on the same week as LPGA final stage of Q school. So of course, I felt like I had to go to Q school. So I didn't go to Dubai, and I ended up missing out on keeping my full status by not very much money on the money list. I can't remember the amount, but it was like if I had gone to Dubai and just made the cut, I would have kept full status on the European tour. And instead, I went to LPGA Q school, didn't get my card, and then so then I had to play on the Symetra Tour the next year. I had no other choice. So, looking back, there's probably a few things I would have done differently, but once again, I'm just extremely thankful that I had the opportunity to go to all those places.
Hey folks, we're going to press pause on our conversation with Mallory for a minute to talk about KT Tape, our presenting sponsor. Going to play a little audio bite from Kerry Walsh Jennings, who is a pretty successful athlete, only won a few gold medals in the Olympics, nothing to write home about or anything, but obviously she's one of the most influential female sports athletes in recent history. She's a KT Tape user, and she's going to talk a little about how it's helped her and why it could help you as well.
I'm training for my sixth Olympics. More than ever before, I have to work hard to stay in shape. I run, I lift, I do yoga. That means sore knees, sore back, sore everything. KT Tape helps me push past the pain.
KT Tape is used by athletes around the world to relieve the pain of aching muscles and joints so they can perform at their best. Super easy to apply. Use it for many common injuries. KT Tape. Train longer. Finish stronger.
KT Tape works for me. It'll work for you.
With that, we're going to go ahead and get back to our conversation with Mallory. And as always, thanks to KT Tape for your support of this podcast. You brought up Ireland a couple of different times, and later down the road, that ended up being a very significant place for your life, both as a golfer and a person, with the big break.
Yep.
So we could probably do an entire podcast on your experience on this show alone. But let's start out with the basics of how the opportunity came about for you to participate in this season.
Yeah. So back in those days, they basically just had open auditions. And I had had a really close friend of mine, Sarah Brown, who had been on Big Break. I think hers was like Dominican Republic, mm-hmm. a couple seasons before mine. So we were good friends. And I heard about, that they were having this open audition at a Symetra Tour event. And that was in March, I believe, of 2011. And so I was like, I saw what it did for her, like as far as, her ability to get sponsors after the show and all of that kind of stuff. So I was like, I'm just going to audition and see what happens. So I went to the audition, and basically they, interview you for 5 or 10 minutes, and they film you hitting a couple balls, and then they say, all right, well, we'll be in touch in a couple months if we pick you. And so I got contacted in May of that year, and they said, you're one of our final candidates, and we had to get all they had to check and make sure I had a passport and all that kind of stuff. And then, yeah, sure enough, they said, you've been selected. And so it's all very, very secretive the way it works. So basically, they sent us this big packet of information saying they don't tell you where you're going. They basically just kind of told you how to pack. They said you're going somewhere with weather similar to the U.S. Northeast in the spring. You need to pack for weather between, 40 degrees and 65 degrees. Be prepared for rain, blah, blah, blah. So literally, we didn't know where we were going, I think, until like the day before leaving, when they actually sent your airline ticket. They told you, what time your flight was, but then I didn't know where I was going until the day before we left. They had us all meet, we all flew into Newark, and they had us in the, I think it was the United Lounge. United was one of the sponsors. And that's kind of where all the competitors met. And of course, they filmed that. And I don't know if you've watched the season, but, my parents like to, refer to the quote of when they showed Julian, and I was like, who's this guy? Because he came in with his hoodie looking all scruffy. And, I'm sure that they strategically placed that, in the show, because they knew by the time the show started airing, they knew that we were dating. So I'm sure that they, strategically placed that, knowing that. But Big Break was just an absolutely unbelievable experience. And there's just nothing like it that I'm sure I'll ever do again.
Well, to that point, one thing about it that always fascinated me about the Big Break was that each day you have no idea what you're going to be doing in terms of a competition. Sometimes it's chipping contest, other times it's trying to hit a punch shot through a pane of glass. You have no idea what you're planning for, and you're never doing any sort of real stroke play or match play like we're all accustomed to until the championship match usually.
Right.
So what was it like for you daily, just going in with a blank slate, not really knowing how you were going to be tested amongst everyone else?
Yeah. I mean, it's such a grueling, basically it's filmed in 2 weeks, and it is just an exhausting, grueling 2 weeks. So basically kind of the way it works is that you get up, they, film your breakfast, 'cause that's kind of where they give you your clue of what you're going to do that day. So, breakfast usually started filming at 6 a.m. So we're up at 4:30 getting ready, film breakfast, and then you go to the golf course. And, the behind the scenes that people don't see is that it takes forever. The filming just absolutely takes forever because, they've got to set up all the shots and the cameras, and then they have to go through basically before every challenge. The show lawyer had to explain what the challenge was. We had to sign papers that we understood what the challenge was and all of the stuff. And then, it's like you've warmed up, and by the time you hit your shot in the challenge, it could be 2 hours later. And, being in Ireland where it was freezing some days, it was like I just hit balls 2 hours ago and now I'm sitting here like freezing to death. Good luck with your, 150 shot, hit it in the circle or you're going to elimination. Like, it was really, really intense. And that was the thing about it. It's like, it's just so, I know watching the show, and I'll admit, like before I was on the show, I would watch it too and be like, this shot is not that hard. Like these people, what are they doing? Like they're hitting these terrible shots. But just knowing that it's like do or die, you have to hit this shot in this circle right now, or you're going to elimination. I mean, it's a lot of pressure. And at that point, I had played in the Craft Nabisco Championship as an amateur, the LPGA Major. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't played in the US Open yet, but I mean, it was by far more pressure on the show than playing in a major as an amateur.
I'm sure. And like the other thing too, I have no clue who it was who said it, but I do remember someone from some season saying that you have no opportunity to recover. Like if you had a bad tee shot in a regular round of golf, then you can try to make up for, maybe turn a double bogey into a bogey. But
exactly.
Not in the big break.
No, it's just do it right now or you're out.
Yeah.
So
the other element with pressure that I want to bring up is you talked about how you've had experience in a major championship up to this point, but for probably 90-95% of the people who played in the big break, they really wouldn't have had a lot of exposure in a tournament that's on a national scale, typically mini tours, maybe something like US AM or Women's AM would be maybe the extent of what it would be for most contestants, I think.
Right.
But on the big break, you've got a national TV audience watching you, and they're not just watching your golf swing. They're seeing what you're like away from the golf course in a Big Brother type household as well. So was it kind of on your mind at all that like people could be watching anything that you say or do at any point? And then what was it like afterwards watching yourself on TV and seeing how the public received you basically?
Yeah, absolutely. The contract that you sign, before going on the show, is extensive. And, reading through all of it, you're like, oh my gosh, they can edit this, basically however they want. So there was definitely that component. Obviously it's not live TV, but I definitely went into it kind of thinking to myself, okay, just, make sure you think through what you're saying in all these interviews and, don't be, just be nice. Don't talk bad about anybody. Like, you can say something that's totally, innocent, and then they can place it somewhere else. Like you maybe weren't even talking about that part of the show. And, looking back when we watched it, there were definitely times where it's like, especially in the little commercials, like I remember, I think it was like the second to last episode, Mark Murphy, they used a snippet of his quote in like a teaser commercial, and it ended up when in the actual episode, it was completely different. And it like sounded dramatic in the commercial, but it really wasn't that dramatic. But yeah, there was actually the episode where Bennett got sick and he had to sit out. Our team lost that day. I was really, really upset about it. And I got super passionate and kind of like lost my mind a little bit. And I was so nervous for that episode to air because I just didn't know, they could have portrayed me, they could have used some footage where I was really upset about the situation, and they could have, used it to make me look like a completely different person. And thankfully they didn't. But yeah, I mean, you're on camera basically all the time. And it's like, you get kind of comfortable with the mics on and the cameras on, and not that you forget, but like, we would be sitting on our team bench or whatever. And like, just having a quiet conversation amongst ourselves. And then you're like, oh man, like they're listening. Sometimes I would forget that. So, yeah.
Well, with you brought it up earlier, but so many people go on the big break thinking that this could be the opportunity for them to get their literal big break and make it on the PGA or LPGA tour and do something like Tony Finau did when he was on the show. But for you and Julian, you guys ended up falling in love and probably had a more significant benefit from the show more than just professional golf. So how did the relationship materialize? What was it that kind of attracted the two of you to one another? And then how did things progress during the show and then after filming?
Yeah, so we were on separate teams. And so the way they had it was, you know, our teams were three guys and three girls, and then we stayed in the house with our own team. And so we weren't actually allowed at the end of the day, like once we got back to our houses, we were completely separated from the other team. We weren't allowed to go to each other's houses. They were right next door. And so the houses both had balconies. And so like we'd go out there and, you know, talk to each other or whatever. But yeah, so I mean, we really didn't have much, you know, contact other than at the golf course. And of course, at the golf course, we were also basically separated into teams. So had he and I not both played well enough to make it so far in the show, you know, we may not have really gotten to know each other as well. So basically, the way it kind of worked was that, you know, towards the end of the show, as people got eliminated, he ended up being the last man standing on his team. So the rest of his team had been eliminated. And it was Andy and Mark and me on my team, and then Julian on his team. And so once his team got eliminated, they moved him from his house into our house. And then the next day we had a golf day off because we were like shooting the promos and like the beginning of the show and the scene openings and all of that kind of stuff. So we went off site to this castle in Ireland to do all these, you know, photo shoots and video shoots and stuff. And then, you know, we kind of just were talking and, you know, just getting to know each other and, you know, nothing romantic, just, you know, getting to know each other as people. And so then, you know, so then I guess the next day was when Andy got eliminated. And so we just kind of got to know each other basically. And after the show ended, he ended up staying in Ireland. He and Mark were close, like got to be good friends. And Mark's sister was getting married in Ireland, and Mark invited him to stay in Ireland for a week and come to the wedding. That's just the kind of guy that Mark is. Mm-hmm. So Julian stayed in Ireland with him for a week, and we were like texting, and you know, he was kind of like between, he had kind of stopped playing, he was caddying a little bit, and then he basically texted me a couple weeks later and said, "Hey, I have a buddy pass on American Airlines. Can I come caddy for you in your tournament this week?" And so he flew to Cincinnati and caddied for me in the Symmetra Tour event. And we've just basically been together ever since.
That's awesome. I remember seeing, you know, several years after the show that y'all were engaged, and like I watched the show living in Colorado. It's where I grew up, and I had Kentucky furthest thing from my radar at that point, but I thought it was really cool seeing that afterwards. It's like, you know, you've got these two people who I think everyone would say were a couple of the more popular people in Big Break history tying the knot. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it was you know, we definitely didn't go there looking for that, obviously. But it kind of just, you know, happened. And you know, obviously that's, I'm more thankful for that than anything else.
Yeah, and it led to you getting on the Big Break for a second time, which was Puerto Rico. And I think it's fair to say this was probably at the point where the show is maybe starting to, you know, kind of tip downwards towards the end of its run. But yeah. What was it like being on for a second time? And I know that there was a NFL element involved with it. How did that compare to the original one in Ireland?
Yeah. So, you know, once again, it's like everything is so secretive. You don't know where you're going. You don't know what the format's going to be. And I'll have to admit, I was really looking forward to, you know, kind of a second shot at the show and, you know, some redemption. And when we got there, they told us we were going to be on teams. And, you know, I had already been on a Big Break that involved teams, and I was kind of disappointed, I'll be honest, because I, you know, from my experience on Big Break Ireland, you know, I thrived under the pressure of all those times I had to go to elimination when the pressure was just on me alone. And so I was really hoping that it would be an individual show in Puerto Rico. So I'll have to admit, I was a little bit disappointed that we were on teams. And so, you know, they had us playing practice rounds with our teammate. And so that was, we had a whole day of thinking that it was just, you know, a guy girl team, like me and Will Lowry were a team. Well, then the next day we're filming on the beach. And, you know, of course the surprise, Tom Abbott says, well, actually you have another teammate. And so, you know, these people started coming out and I'm not really an NFL fan. I mean, I'll watch it occasionally, but not, you know, I didn't really know who any of the people were until Jerry Rice came out. You know, it was funny because when they announced, so Jerry was the last one they announced. So Tim, I think, was second to last. So Tim came out and like he did the Heisman pose. And I'm like, oh, okay, so he must have won the Heisman. So that's pretty cool. Like, that's a big deal. But I had no idea who Tim was. And then, of course, Jerry Rice came out at the end, and I did know who he was. But so it was definitely, you know, it was a very different dynamic, you know, having, you know, amateurs who, you know, were Hall of Fame NFL players, but, you know, their golf skills were at times a little iffy.
Yeah.
But it was also, it was really cool. And, you know, I looking back, I wouldn't have changed it because it was a really cool opportunity to just learn from them. You know, we ate dinner with them every night and like all together as a big group, you know, and just hearing them talk about their careers and, you know, all the stuff that they accomplished. It was really cool. So, and I was thankful. Tim Brown was an amazing teammate. He's an amazing man. Really strong Christian, learned a lot from him while we were there. And I think probably the highlight of that experience was in the elimination match against Jerry Rice's team, where our team ended up getting eliminated. I was going up against Isaac Sanchez, and I made a couple just really clutch shots and putts to extend the match. And afterwards, Jerry Rice came up and said that it was one of the most impressive athletic performances he had ever seen. And I was like, what? Like, so that was probably the highlight of the week for me.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. He's made and seen some pretty nice athletic achievements himself. So that is
absolutely
cool.
Well, and I think it was cool for them, you know, especially because, I mean, I have to assume that, you know, most of the NFL players on the show, you know, maybe they had seen, you know, some men professional golfers, but I would have to probably guess that they maybe hadn't really watched a lot of women professional golfers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that they were, you know, kind of like, oh, wow, like these girls are pretty good.
Yeah, that's awesome. So after that show, kind of your last couple years really going full at it professionally, you won our Women's Open in 2014 at Keene Run. And then I think it was the next year you played in your second Women's Open, U.S. Women's Open, that is. But then things just kind of evolved from that point. So what were those last years like playing professionally? And then what led to you transitioning away from focusing solely on playing?
Yeah, so 2014, I had a really good year. I won a tournament on the Symetra Tour, and I had several top 10s and basically was going into the Tour Championship. So at that time, the top 10 players on the Symetra Tour got full status on the LPGA for the next year. And so I was in 10th place on the money list going into the last tournament, and I was only ahead of the girl that was in 11th place on the money list by $8 for the entire season. So I knew that I had to beat her. I knew that I needed to play well. And Julian was there that week. He had the week off from caddying, so he was there with me, caddying for me. You know, it came down to the wire. It was really, really close. And so that tournament ended on Sunday. And then we happened to be getting married like 5 days later on Friday. So that was an extremely intense week, you know, just not only like the obviously trying to earn my LPGA Tour card, but like finalizing the last little bits of the wedding and all of that stuff.
Right.
So I did it. I earned my card. I think I ended up, like I was ahead of the 11th position by like $1,000. So, I mean, in the grand scheme of an entire golf season, that's obviously not very much. It's a shot here or there. So yeah, earned my full LPGA tour status on a Sunday. We got married on the next Friday, September 26th. And then it was kind of just like, whoa, like a lot just happened. And I kind of went through a little bit of a letdown, I think. You know, I had always had the goal of, you know, playing full status on the LPGA tour, but I kind of didn't really think far enough into, okay, well, what happens when I achieve that goal? Like, what are my next goals? And I think the timing of everything too, you know, with getting married at that point, I was, you know, a little bit older and, you know, kind of my focus was starting to change a little bit. And it was like, you know, our first year of marriage, I was playing on the LPGA. He was caddying on the PGA Tour at that time for Graham Dillette. You know, our schedules were insane. We never got to go home. On his off weeks, he would come to my tournaments to see me. On my off weeks, I would go to his tournaments. You know, and then, of course, if I'm, you know, in a random city at a PGA Tour event, trying to look for a place to practice and a gym. And, you know, it just really wasn't very conducive to being super successful. I had also had some health issues at that time, and I'd had to have a surgery in the off season of 2014. So I probably didn't really quite get prepared well enough. And basically I just really struggled in 2015. I played 17 LPGA events and I made one cut. And, you know, once again, it was our first year of marriage and it was just a really, really tough year. And I did end up going to Q school at the end of 2015. Didn't make the cut there. And so I knew I had full Symetra Tour status for 2016. But after Q school, I kind of just said, you know what, I'm just going to take a little break. I've got, you know, I can go play on the Symetra Tour if I decide to go do that. But I'm just going to take a little break and see if kind of the desire to go back comes up. And so, you know, I didn't really know what I was going to do. But like I said, Julian had been caddying for Graham Dillette. They had actually just had their twins, like in November of 2015. And so, you know, we were really close with them. We both lived in Scottsdale at that time. And so one night we'd gone over there for dinner and Ruby, Graham's wife, was like, well, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to go back and play? And I said, you know, honestly, I don't know. Like, I'm just going to take a break until I really wake up and miss it and really have the desire to go back. And so she said, well, we were going to hire a nanny to travel with us and help me with the twins. Like, would you just want to travel with us and help me with the kids? And I was like, well, yeah, that sounds amazing. Cause I can, you know, travel with Jules and we'll all just be hanging out together. And so basically I was just going to kind of do that until, like I said, until I really woke up with the desire to, you know, go practice. And, you know, if I really missed playing. And I just never really felt like that. So, yeah, so that was kind of it for me.
And then you become a mom, obviously. And what's your focus on now professionally? What is it that you concentrate on from a work standpoint?
Yeah, so up until recently, so after I nannied for the Dillettes for a couple of years, my former management company, it's called Fairway Management. Sherry Way is the primary agent. So she represented me when I was on tour. And we had kind of always talked about me working for her once I was done playing. So, you know, Graham kind of started having some issues with his back. Ruby and the kids weren't traveling as much. And so I kind of transitioned into working for Sherry. And so I was a player manager for Fairway Management for a couple years, which basically meant that I was still traveling on the PGA Tour, working with our clients at that time, who included, you know, Billy Horschel and Sam Ryder and Lonto Griffin was one of our clients. So I was kind of going to the tournaments, helping them, you know, just like coordinate media appearances or sponsor engagement activities, stuff like that. And so I was doing that even after having Madeline, and then COVID hit, and then agents and managers were not part of the PGA Tour bubble. So my entire, you know, job basically kind of got shut down. And so Sherry, you know, when it was apparent that COVID wasn't going anywhere, you know, she called and said, hey, you know, I would really, because I was an independent contractor. And so she said, you know, I'd really like you to, you know, continue working, but we just have to figure out kind of a different role. So I ended up taking over kind of from our end, Billy Horschel and Lonto Griffin both host an AJGA tournament in their names. So I was kind of helping, you know, coordinate with the AJGA from our end of running those two events. And then Lonto hosted his first ever charity event benefiting his foundation last September. And so I was the lead on that event. And so that was a huge undertaking. It was extremely successful. We met our fundraising goals. We had a, you know, it was like a Brantley Gilbert concert and then a golf tournament the next day. It was at Valley Hack. One of his sponsors is the Dormy Network. And so it was a really, really amazing event. But I think I kind of bit off a little bit more than I could chew. And I didn't really quite realize how much work all of that was going to be. And so, you know, like I said, I was just kind of working part-time doing all of that. And then, you know, obviously trying to manage being a mom of a toddler and, you know, she doesn't go to like childcare full-time or anything. So it was just a lot to manage. So, yeah. I basically just got to the point where I was like, you know, this isn't really working for me. And so I talked to Sherry and, you know, I don't necessarily know that I'm done with that forever. Cause I think, you know, maybe at some point I could go back to that cause I really did enjoy it. So I kind of took a step back from that at the end of 2021. And so now my primary focus is just being a mom. And then, I've actually gotten into helping my mom. We're trying to kind of develop some new junior programs, potentially some women's programs. And I think we're about to try to start actually like a toddler kind of parent child class. So she teaches at HP Golf Academy. So we've been doing some supervised practice with some of her existing students on Sunday afternoons. And so I'm kind of dabbling in that a little bit and trying to help her with some of that stuff. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. And I know we're getting close to our time limit here, but I do want to bring up one thing specifically, since you've got a lot of experience playing and now you're doing all this stuff with high performance and you've had other experience with lots of golf avenues. Young girls and their parents, obviously, it's a very, how do I want to put it, a very sought after thing for girls to, you know, make it to college golf, thrive and get a scholarship. Whether it's just getting to that point or probably more importantly, just having fun and enjoying it, what advice would you give for young girls and their parents who are trying to, you know, figure their way out and maximize both enjoyment and success on the golf course?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, for, I guess I'll speak to the parents first. I mean, I think the biggest thing is to just try to let your kid lead the way as far as, you know, how interested they are and, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, for me, one of the most important things that my parents, you know, ever said when I was growing up playing is that, you know, when I started, they're like, okay, it's not about being the best 11-year-old. It's not about being the best 15-year-old. It's not even about being the best 18-year-old. Of course, if you want to go to college on a scholarship, you know, you've got to be competitive at those ages. But, you know, for me, knowing the ultimate goal was to play on the tour, you know, it really wasn't about being the best teenager. And it was more about, you know, developing your fundamentals and your skills and making sure that you had a good foundation so that you can continue to, you know, kind of just go up the ladder and achieve things along the way. And, you know, it's really important to, you know, make sure that your kid is enjoying it. And, you know, as a golfer, you put enough pressure on yourself and, you know, you really don't need any external pressure along the way because, you know, if you want to be a good player yourself, you know, trust me, you're putting all that pressure on yourself and being hard enough on yourself as it is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great advice. And I think that's a really good spot to end on here. Mallory, I want to thank you so much for your time and being very forthright and just very, very open about all the different stuff you've done and experienced. It's really cool. And I said at the beginning, you're probably the most interesting woman in Kentucky golf. And I think after well, the last hour, can probably make that argument even more so now. But thank you again for your time. Really enjoyed it. Hopefully we can have you back on again down the road, but it's been a pleasure and hopefully we'll meet face to face sometime soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much. I'm hoping, you know, maybe I'm thinking about dusting off my clubs, maybe to try to play in the Kentucky Open at some point. I can't guarantee it'll be this year, but I'm hope that's on my radar.